Blog Talk Radio.
Progressive News Network Extra. My name is Brooke Hines, and I am so glad to be with you here this afternoon, this evening, perhaps you're making dinner, to talk about the Democratic presidential debate from last night. First, let me tell you a little bit about, I got some show notes for this Sunday. We have a really interesting lineup for Sunday. And so don't miss this live or catch it on your podcatcher on iTunes or catch the pod. We've got Rick Spezak did an interview with former Congressman Alan Grayson on his new book, High Crimes, The Impeachment of Donald Trump. He had a really good time with that. The book is a really breezy read. It's a history of impeachment in the United States. And in the fashion of which most are accustomed to reading Alan Grayson, he has written this book in that particular voice. So it's a breezy read. It's a fun read. Rick Spezak had a really good, really fun time with it. I'll be back with a little bit more of a in-depth dive into the Democratic debate. We also have Jeanine Maloff, who will be talking about GOP plans to carve up Social Security disability benefits. This is really important for the disability community, but it's also important for just people generally, because at some point we all get sick. Do not miss that. She comes on at 8:30 most Sunday nights. We also have Fallon Loughley, director of Field Team 6, part of the Florida Democratic Party's new GOTV initiative. Loughley is also a Move On activist, and I believe was down at the impeachment rally in Stewart, which had 300 people in attendance, which is amazing. Okay, you guys know my thoughts on impeachment. You don't need to hear them again. I'm not a huge fan of the whole process right now. I'm not a huge fan of, very much not a huge fan of Russiagate. And, but having said that, let's see how this plays out. Impeachment was voted on, and now we're waiting to see how it either goes or doesn't go to the Senate, whether there's a trial or not a trial. And who gets called if there is a trial. There's still a lot to be worked out there. Having said that, it's Friday, December 20. Last night, Thursday, December 19, was the sixth Democratic presidential debate. This one was hosted by Politico and PBS. It was it's about right in the middle. So we've got it looks like we've got six more debates left. I'm going to check on that while I play some clips later on and make sure. But I believe we had 12 debates scheduled for the whole election year. We've already had six in 2019. That leaves six more left. Interesting stuff. This debate, Andrew Yang was the only person of color on stage. There were two women, Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren. Only seven people on stage. And somehow that only seven people included Tom Steyer. I have no idea why or how he was up there, what purpose he serves. I mean, he's not, it's not like he's like offensive or anything. I mean, if you know about him, what he, the way he made his money is pretty offensive in private prisons and in coal industry, but you know, just being on the debate stage, he's fine. You know, it's not like he adds that much or takes away that much. I started off thinking, and I think from my experience and observations last night on social media, I think a lot of people were in the same boat that I am. And I started out this debate really annoyed. You know, I just sensed a lot of entitlement and a lot of bad energy, I guess you could call it, just aggressively elitist energy coming from the moderators, and it really turned me off really quick. But I stuck with it, and I stuck with listening to people on social media who I trust and who I respect, who were making some really good points about what was happening on that stage. And I'm really glad I did, because I might have just turned it off, even though I am hopelessly addicted to presidential politics, especially presidential politics with Bernie Sanders in the running. I just for whatever reason, I wasn't in the mood. You know, it's just a few more days until Christmas. And it wouldn't surprise me if this debate wasn't the least watched debate of all of them, which would be a shame, because having seen it and having gone through all of the commentary today that I could possibly cram in my head, I think it was the best debate, and I think other people are saying that too. And just to give you a feeling of where we're at, okay, I've got it confirmed. 12 debates total. This was the sixth. We're right up against Christmas, so I'm thinking that the viewership of this debate is going to be less than 6 million, because the November 20 debate had 6.6 million watching live and 1.3 million watching streaming. And compare that to the very first debate, which had a total of 24.3 million viewers, and that's 15.3 million live and 9 million streaming. The second debate actually had even more viewers. It was 27 compared to 24. 27.1 million viewers, 18.1 million live, and 9 million streaming. And it's frittered down since then. So I wouldn't be surprised if this particular debate, which was hosted by PBS and Politico at Loyola University in Los Angeles, the Gersten Pavilion, I wouldn't be surprised if the viewership was even less. But who knows? You know, people are off for the holidays. I've had my husband here at home for a week, and we're doing fine. I'm joking. We are doing fine. But people tend to take off work at the end of the year, because guess what? We can't take off during the year for vacation. Number one, a lot of us can't afford to go on vacation. And number two, sometimes we just don't get around to it. You know, sometimes our schedules don't align. And often my schedule doesn't align with my husband's schedule, because I tend to work in political consulting, which goes by its own clock. Speaking of, by the way, speaking of political consulting, I do political consulting. Reach out to me on Twitter. You can DM me. My DMs are open. If you are a progressive who is running for office anywhere in the United States and you're needing some just general help, you know, if you're just looking for, what do I do? What do I do next? Shoot me a DM. Let's have a conversation. I'll try to talk you through some stuff and try to make some introductions to people who could possibly help you in your area of the country. And, you know, my wheelhouse is branding and direct mail, anything having to do with design, anything having to do with writing. So, you know, websites, walk cards, anything like that, t-shirts. I'm your girl. And if I'm not your girl, I'm going to help you find the right person to help you guys. So, you know, just keep that in mind. We got to keep this movement going. And last night, I think that this debate, it really kept me going. You know, let's start out with some generalities. You know, we mentioned the viewership. We mentioned Yang being the only person of color and that there's two women on stage. Do not miss, this is kind of a sidebar, but do not miss Katie Halper's quite lengthy examination of Yamiche Alcindor. And I'm not going to be saying her. Maybe I said it right. Yamiche Alcindor. She was one of the moderators on the panel last night. And she has a long storied history of hostility towards Bernie Sanders. So I know a lot of us, myself included, were watching the debate last night with an eye, keeping an eye on Alcindor and making sure that our candidate was being treated fairly. I got to say that when all is said and done, she did not pull any of the stunts last night, at least that I noticed. She didn't pull any of the stunts last night that she's known for. Now, just as a refresher, she's known for using innuendo and, you know, buttonholing the candidate to try and admit that he's sexist for staying in the race in 2016, you know, to, you know, get his delegates in place and to go into the convention. She's also known for blaming Bernie Sanders for the shooting of the softball game, the congressional softball game, because the shooter had been a Bernie Sanders supporter. So, of course, Bernie Sanders was completely responsible for a horrific shooting. And that's all her work. Katie Halper has noted every single one of these instances, it looks like. This is a 12-page piece that I printed out. And oh my gosh, what a mess. And I'm really glad, you know, maybe it's PBS reeling in this particular reporter and demanding a higher level of professionalism. Alcindor had been at the New York Times, and, you know, it just ain't what it used to be over there. Moving on. Here's an article from Vice. Came out today. Zeeshan Aleem. Sanders is hot in the polls and still treated like a second-tier candidate. The subhead is, there's evidence that the Sanders surge in the polls is being ignored. Is this a repeat of the type of blackout that happened in 2016? So this is a pretty good rundown of the Bernie blackout. I'm glad to be seeing it get some coverage in the media and not just amongst us guys on Twitter who have been noticing it. You know, the Bernie blackout didn't start this year. Probably the best example that I can think of the Bernie blackout is there was a time in 2016 when Bernie was giving one of his biggest speeches to one of his biggest crowds out side in a stadium in the cold, one of these kind of situations. And MSNBC, instead of even mentioning that Bernie Sanders was attracting like 5,000 people out in the cold to go see him, instead of mentioning that, they had their camera trained live on an empty podium waiting for Trump to come and have something to say. They split the screen, so you had Chris Hayes on one side going, any minute now, here's going to come Donald Trump, and he's going to finally say the thing that makes everybody go, oh my God, he's crazy. That didn't happen. What did happen was the Bernie blackout was burnished, and I want to suggest to you guys, this is in my notes, I want to suggest to you guys that something is shifting in this whole Bernie blackout thing. This is an observation that I have come to just in the last couple of days, because it seems to me that just in the last couple of days, things have changed just a little bit. Now, what's changing is that suddenly people are starting to mention Bernie Sanders. First of all, he's actually getting mentioned in the media, and this press from this article from Vice Magazine, I think, is a good example of that. But last night, Donna Brazile actually tweeted out that that we shouldn't be dismissing Bernie Sanders, that Bernie Sanders is actually one of the leading people in the race. And I shared that over in some DM groups and, you know, asked people, hey, what's up with this? You know, what's the next shoe to drop here? We're also seeing MSNBC, even the likes of Mika Brzezinski on Morning Joe, we're seeing these types of folks actually start talking about Bernie Sanders. I'm going to have a clip on that in a second. What is going on? Well, I have a theory. I have a theory about what's going on there. I think, and I believe I can back this up, I think that my unpopular opinion, which has been for the last month or so, my unpopular opinion has been that a Bernie / Elizabeth Warren ticket would be unbeatable. Now, you know, I don't know if that's an unpopular opinion. I think that's just a statement of fact. I think if you put those two together, that you would have a fairly unbeatable ticket. And that's just talking about electability. I'm not saying that that's the thing to do. I'm just saying that that would be quite a strong ticket. I'm also starting to see now that people within Bernie's campaign, Waleed Shaheed, today in particular, are tweeting out and communicating some rather positive things about Elizabeth Warren. And notice last night, too, that Elizabeth and Bernie did not go after each other. They've never gone after each other. They've, you know, looked like the cute little, you know, New England couple, you know, with the little glasses and the, you know, gray hair or whatever. They're really kind of adorable together, is what my husband keeps saying. They're adorable together. I'd love to see them on a ticket. I think that the reason why we're seeing some softening in the media is that there is a whisper campaign. This is just speculation. I could be totally wrong, but I'm sensing a whisper campaign behind the scenes that goes something like, you know, Bernie Warren might just run away with it. Bernie and Warren seems to be riding the zeitgeist. Bernie and Warren, we put those two together, we'd make two disparate groups within the Democratic Party. We would bring them together. And I think that these conversations are starting to be held behind the scenes, and that this is why we're seeing some softening in the attitude towards Bernie Sanders. Total speculation. Take it for what it is. But also keep an eye on it. Keep an eye on it. More observations from last night. I missed Tulsi's energy. Boy, did I miss Tulsi's energy. you know, on the other hand, last night's debate was there was a sense of commodiousness. Especially from Bernie Sanders, and I expect this from Bernie Sanders, there was a sense of commodiousness when he offered a contrast between himself and another candidate. So, for instance, when he, contrasted his fundraising with Buttigieg's and with Biden's and said that they've got some competition to do with the billionaires. He was being charming about that. He wasn't being mean about that. He wasn't being angry about that. And in doing so, he offered quite the contrast between himself and Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete last night had a terrible night. It was awful. And it's awful from the standpoint of being a woman watching this, because for one, the only people he attacked, the only people Mayor Pete Buttigieg attacked last night were women. And when he attacked the women, when he went after them, he was angry. There's a GIF going around that's a close up of him tightening his fist at the podium and having to take his other hand to untighten it. You know, like that is how out of control his emotions were on the inside. So something's wrong there. You know, he's not happy. He's not happy at all. He's not comfortable at all when people offer a contrast. And, you know, look, I know I'm not the only person who did debate or even model in Security Council competition. You must know, you know, that when you allow yourself to get aggravated or to feel, you know, rising emotions during one of these debates or, you know, public speaking, this, that, and the other, when you let somebody get under your skin, you've lost. You've just lost. And Pete Buttigieg had so many moments last night where he lost it, and that makes him appear like a loser, especially when he's losing it vis-a-vis a couple of women like Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren. Now, two things about Klobuchar and Warren. Number one, I think Mike Figueroa said it best about Amy Klobuchar, that she shines with the light of 1,000 Karens when she's attacking Pete. And he might have actually said heat. So she shines with the heat of 1,000 Karens. You know, that energy, let me see your manager energy. And that is absolutely true. But last night, Amy Klobuchar, man, girl took her Xanax. There was no shaky. There was no... You know, I didn't feel like she was having breathing trouble. You know how when you get stressed or you get a little bit off balance and your breathing gets out of sync with the way that you speak? She suffered that terribly in the last debate, to the point where it became a joke on Saturday Night Live. Not that Saturday Night Live should be anybody's cultural measure for anything, for God's sakes. But turning from Klobuchar to Elizabeth Warren, these debates, you know, she had like one really good debate, and then she backpedaled on her Medicare for All. She backpedaled on some policies, and so you got this whole thing where you have Elizabeth Warren sounding really good at the outset and saying a lot of things that people want to hear about Medicare for All and about policies going forward that can really help Americans who desperately need it right now, like tuition-free college and so on and so forth. And then she dialed all of those back. As soon as she like put them out there, she reeled them right back in. And people noticed that, you know, for all of the folks like Sally, what's her name? Sally, it's not Sally Jesse Raphael. It's a Sally that used to be one of the big nachos here at the Florida Democratic Party. She famously, when she first took the job, must have been executive director, she must have been ED, she famously said that nobody cares about policy, that what they really care about is personality, and what they really care about is style. And we're going to talk about this in a second, too. The two are intimately connected. And you don't have style that has any kind of meaning unless you have the policy to back it up. And it's really hard to have any meaningful style, likewise, if you don't have the policy to back it up. So these are, you know, they're like the yin and the yang of electoral politics. You really can't just have one and not the other. It doesn't work that way. We're not complete morons out here. Quit treating us like we are. It's really annoying. Andrew Yang. Let's actually start out our discussion tonight, our collection of clips with Andrew Yang, because I think Andrew Yang had, bar none, the best response on the impeachment question. And you know, just thank the gods that they got this impeachment stuff out of the way at the very beginning of the debate, because I don't think I could have gone listening to much more, you know, showboating on this. And it's just tiring, you guys. We have an election to win. This impeachment, no matter what you think about it, we're going to have a problem if impeachment and the 2020 election start bumping heads. It's going to be difficult. We're going to talk about that in a second. But here, listen to Andrew Yang talk about impeachment, talk about Donald Trump.
Jobs there. The more we act like Donald Trump is the cause of all of our problems, the more Americans lose trust that we can actually see what's going on in our communities and solve those problems. What we have to do is we have to stop being obsessed over impeachment, which unfortunately strikes many Americans like a ball game where you know what the score is going to be, and start actually digging in and solving the problems that got Donald Trump elected in the first place. We have to take every opportunity to present a new positive vision for the country, a new way forward to help beat him in 2020, because make no mistake, he'll be there at the ballot box for us to defeat.
Okay. Look, that's Andrew Yang making a whole heck of a lot of sense right there, you know? And, you know, to a lot of people, I'm going to be totally fair. I am not a Yang person. I think that his campaign is really gimmicky. But I also sense a large libertarian energy from Andrew Yang. I sense the desire to use corporations to solve problems, which in my part of the world we call that neoliberalism. However, as someone who is an outsider, Andrew Yang has the ability to say things like this and to get traction with them in a way that other candidates can't. And let me tell you why that is. Because if Bernie Sanders went out there and said the same thing about impeachment that Andrew Yang said about impeachment here, as someone who needs to be more of an insider than he is, you know, with all of this, but he isn't even a Democrat kind of a critique of Bernie Sanders. He doesn't have the political capital, I don't believe, in that area to push back super hard on impeachment / Russiagate. I think that he is trying to go with the flow on that. Likewise, I think that he did similarly with regard to Venezuela and Maduro and, you know, kind of took a pass on that, had a bye week on that, and could not ignore when the Bolivia coup rolled around. And so he just spoke up on the Bolivia coup. I think you push Bernie Sanders far enough and he's like, no, I got to say something. I don't think that he sees impeachment as one of those put his foot down moments. And I also think that he sees that as something that he has more to lose than to gain by going against the party at this point. And let me tell you, the party has hung it out there. So it's a discussion for another time, but there are some real challenges going forth with the Senate. I'll try to get into that a little bit next week, which will be more timely, as a matter of fact. All right, moving on. I want to back up my speculation on the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren possible detente, possible plans to team up in the future. It's only possible, but you know, I noticed this earlier today that Waleed Shaheed tweeted out this wonderful clip by Heather McGee at Demos. She was on Democracy Now! And she was doing a contrast. She was talking about the difference between Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg with regard to fundraising and how important it is that that fundraising is not treated like legalized bribery, essentially. She's a lot more articulate at this than I am. So here, have a quick listen. Heather McGee, Demos.
It's a major issue, this question about how these candidates are running their campaign, who they're giving access to, who's got their ear, and therefore, you know, what shape it's going to have on the policymaking. You know, Mayor Pete tried to make the point that Elizabeth Warren started out her career in politics by doing the same kind of fundraising that everybody else does. The only difference here that I think, you know, Senator Warren didn't actually say this, but if you think about who these two people are, is that Senator Warren came into politics and it was very clear what her values were, right? She came into politics on the heels of the financial crisis, of standing up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, of holding people like Jamie Dimon and Tim Geithner accountable, of not being afraid to make enemies, even with Democrats, on issues of, you know, inequality. Pete Buttigieg is more of a cipher, right? He is someone whom a lot of different people, including a lot of billionaires, think this is the kind of moderate we can get behind. This is the kind of moderate maybe we can influence. So that's really the question, right?
Heather McGee, former president of Demos, I stand corrected, it says right there on the clip that was on Democracy Now!, and you hear her right there talking about Pete Buttigieg being a cipher. Now, this week on Jeremy Scahill's Intercepted podcast, he did a deep dive into McKenzie. I think it was this week. Pretty sure it was this week. It was either this week or last week. Did a deep dive into McKenzie and what kind of stuff that Pete Buttigieg was likely doing at McKenzie. And one of his clients at McKenzie was Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. Right after he had been at the helm of the campaign, account managing Blue Cross Blue Shield for McKenzie, they laid off a ton of workers and raised their rates. So I think that we can pretty much glean what it was that he told, how he consulted Blue Cross Blue Shield and in terms of how to do their business. Now, you know, McKenzie, they are in the business. They are the Bobs. They are the Bobs from Office Space. They are the people who come into your job and they say, okay, we're going to fire 40% of you and the rest of you, you don't get pension anymore, as if pension even exists. You're going to be paying three times as much for your health care, et cetera, et cetera. It's all they do. It's like, I mean, McKenzie is a lot like Mitt Romney's vulture capitalist group. It's just what they do. So interesting. I just found it really interesting this morning that Waleed Shaheed tweeted that out, because it is a soft support of Elizabeth Warren. You know, it was saying, Heather McGee there is saying that we know who Elizabeth Warren is. She isn't a cipher. You know, she isn't somebody that we have to guess what she's about. In the language that I would use, you know, we know what her brand is. She has very strong brand identity, and that's not in question at all. There was another really good clip, and I'm going to try to find it here in a second. I'm going to pivot real quick to this, because this is really interesting. It's something I tweeted about last night. Frank Luntz. Y'all know who Frank Luntz is. He is a Republican strategist. And he specializes in communication. He came into prominence during the Clinton administration back in the 90s. He's known for crafting language in an Orwellian manner, actually, crafting language to conceal what they're actually talking about and put forth something else that is more appealing to the audience. So the term death tax has been attributed to Frank Luntz. You know, instead of talking about a state tax, talk about the death tax, because everybody thinks that that's less fair, like nobody should be taxed upon death. He's also responsible for shifting the language away from the term, saying global warming. He's changed that to climate change. So whenever we as environmental activists move our language towards climate change rather than global warming, he's behind it. And I know a lot of people think that climate change is actually a good term, because it kind of, and it seems to encapsulate the phenomena of global weirding, where you've got big storms coming out of nowhere. You have unpredictability in terms of, you know, the jet stream is going all over the place. You got these polar vortexes coming down the way they used to not. They've never done that before. But all of these global weirding, all of this unpredictability within weather and climate is at base due to global warming. It's due to the problem with carbon in the atmosphere. He thought that climate change would sound, you know, a little less urgent or whatever, you know, kind of like, oh, it's going from partly cloudy to partly sunny. That's just a small change. Maybe that's backfired on him at this point, because I think that everybody sees climate change as what it is. It's sea level rise, it's mass displacement, it's climate refugees, and so on and so forth. But that's who Frank Luntz is. And every time there's a presidential debate, Frank Luntz does these focus groups. And last night he did it with the Los Angeles Times with a group of voters in California. And I started catching some of his tweets and some of what was going on in that focus group before the actual debate was over. And I got to tell you, I was freaking floored because, listen, he is throwing down some stuff that I would never expect to hear from Frank Luntz. And this was the very first thing that I saw that he tweeted. He said, from a dial scoring perspective, and that means he's got all of these California voters sitting in a room and they have these little dials. And as the debate goes on, they dial that appeals to me or that doesn't appeal to me. So they use these little contraptions to register and measure their response to what's being said in the debate. Frank Luntz says, from a dial scoring perspective, tonight's hashtag them debate is going better for progressive candidates than for the moderates. My group contains both, referring to his group of California voters. Well thought out and smartly explained progressive policies do well even with centrist Dems. That's amazing. That is just amazing. He did a whole thread on that. Go find it. It's Frank Luntz. So let's dig in to what was going on with Frank Luntz last night and what he was finding, because hoo boy. He's no friend to progressives. I don't know if I need to really belabor this point, but Frank Luntz was the guy who teamed up with Newt Gingrich on the Contract for America and is widely seen as one of the people who really facilitated the postmodern era of no movement between Republicans and Democrats, the lack of bipartisanship. And when I use bipartisanship in this sense, I'm meaning, in a way, coming to terms with important issues that matter to people. I'm not talking about how when Democrats surrender to Republicans, and that's not even like a surrender. They do this, you know, because they agree with them on austerity measures or tax giveaways to the rich or so on and so forth. All of the elite party members who are by definition elite, they agree with that. They want, except for the precious few, like a Tulsi Gabbard, like a Bernie Sanders, like an Elizabeth Warren some of the time. This was something that was new that came out of the Clinton administration. Frank Luntz is one of the people who is credited with that. So for him to say that progressives were having a much better night is fairly significant. That's not all that he said. One of the things that just made my eyeballs pop out was that of the group of people that he brought in for this focus group, only six entered the room as Bernie supporters. But 14, upon the ending of the debate, 14 people were supporting Sanders. He picked up 8 voters in that one room, which I think is just amazing. So I've got some clips here, and I think that these, at least from my own perspective, these clips are some of the best clips from the night. Now I'm going to address some other things that were actually said in the debate, but it's this, you know, who we are as a country wrapping our brains around this debate that I'm finding really interesting today. So let's talk about, here it is, this clip right here, why why Bernie wins. Yeah, let's start out with this one. Here we go. This is a number of voters in this focus group talking about why they believe Bernie Sanders won the debate last night.
What Bernie can do is he can combat Trump. No matter what Trump says, Bernie has an answer for it, and he's going to say it right away. And I have no doubt of his, he's the best speaker on the stage. So
with Bernie, it's one and the same. He communicates what he stands for, because it's not enough to just say you don't like Trump. I mean, of course you don't like Trump, but you got to know what you're for. And I always know what Bernie's for.
And right there, you actually saw that connection between what you believe and how you communicate it. And that's really what's at issue here in this particular exchange. Let's move it. Let's continue on.
As someone who cares much more about the issues and how they communicate, but I think I'm in the minority. I think everyone in this room is in the minority, because we're the kind of people who would show up to this kind of event. Most of America does not care. It's we want to know who has the most charisma, who can yell the loudest, and I think we absolutely want to debate on those grounds alone.
And this is a woman of color who, she is one of the people who raised her hands when Frank Luntz asked what's more important, to have something, to communicate well, or to have a solid policy message. So she was connecting the two from the other side. The other two guys were connecting the two from the policy side. Continuing on.
Yep. It's just interesting that Biden keeps referring to his history as though that's going to remind people that he's presidential. And I think to a lot of people here, everybody sighed when that's mentioned, because it feels like you're not telling me anything specific about the future. You keep telling me what you've done in the past. And a lot of that stuff you've had to change your view on because you've been in politics for so long.
Now, that's a huge insight right now, to hear that within that room of 20 some people, every time Joe Biden talked about, well, I'm the guy who, number one, did this, and number two, did that. If you'll remember, I'm the guy, and that's what he always does. And I know that I want to vomit every time he says it, and it's really nice to, you know, not feel so alone in my nausea that other people are also bothered by this. I think it's one of the weakest things that a candidate, any candidate, can say, is that, I'm the guy who did this in the past, because, listen, you were in the White House, buddy. You were in the White House for 8 years. So if you're so damn good at your job, how come we still have so many people who can't see a doctor? And how come climate change hasn't been, or global warming hasn't been addressed? You know, how come we are still, you know, in shit city with all of this? All right, moving on. Oh, that was the last of it. Okay. A lot of people, here was something that got talked about in the Franklin's focus group that I found fascinating, because I think that there's a misconception that the people who are elastic in their in who they will vote for, I think there's a misconception that that elasticity hews to ideological lines, so that somebody who might be leaning towards Biden would prefer, might move to a Buttigieg, you know, a centrist might move to a centrist, you know. This next quote puts the lie to that. And let me see, 33 seconds, and it's right here. Check this out.
I thought I liked Amy and Biden.
And who do you like?
Definitely Bernie Sanders.
He won you over also. Tell me why.
He's on fire. He wants to be a Democrat.
Did you say fire?
Yeah, he's on fire.
Explain that. I mean,
he's just feverishly hungry to change the America.
So you responded very favorably to him. My question now is, which is a higher priority?
And this is where he starts to go into which is a higher priority, the way that you communicate or the policies that you support. That woman was adorable, by the way. She was very kind of meek about her answer. You know, they came in supporting Biden, but now, oh my goodness, I think they support Bernie. It was just such a nice moment. And, you know, this, she was immediately like one of my favorite people in the world upon hearing that. Let me tell you, my other favorite person in the world from this Frank Luntz thing. Here's somebody who is not afraid to tell the truth. Check this out. I might have to make this some kind of intro to the show. This is beautiful.
I want to see Bernie versus Trump because we're in a class war. That's what it is. It's Medicare for all versus status quo. I want to see where it slides.
This woman is maybe in her late 20s, early 30s, or she could be a very young looking late 30s, early 40s person. You know, she's just like one of these, like, you know, kind of pretty hipster women that, you know, is kind of ageless. And I love the way that she projects this. She says, you know, it has to be Bernie against Trump, because the issue, the main thing that we're dealing with right now is a class war. And that class war, one of the battlefields is Medicare for all. What she doesn't say, and what I would say, is that another one of the battlefields is global warming, climate change. You know, another battlefield that we're going to have this war on has to do with tuition. Look, we've got kids graduating from college who cannot start lives. You cannot buy a house. You cannot have a family. You cannot support yourself, let's say in a suburb, if you've got six figures of debt, which most people are coming out of college with the kind of debt that our parents just can't even imagine. And look, when I say my parents, I'm talking about people who lived through the Great Depression. So I was adopted by my grandparents. They brought me up with this idea that Wall Street was evil and that you never take out loans. Okay. So I've kind of been programmed from birth to not trust these guys. And even so, when Bill Clinton was in office and he was changing pensions over to 401ks and, oh, it's going to be a win-win for everybody because we're going to make more money, blah, 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 and everybody's going to take care of, I fell for it. I totally fell for it, even though I had been programmed and I knew better and I didn't believe it, yada, yada, yada. Also, graduated with a fair share of student loans, actually much fewer student loans than most people who spend as much time as I did in school. And that's because I went to a very cheap school, which, by the way, this is where I need to remind everybody that that I welcome the children of billionaires, every single one of them, to attend free college at East Tennessee State University, where I graduated from. Bring it on. I'm so sure you're going to see a giant uptick in rich kids going to, you know, crappy state schools here and there. It's just, look, guys, it's not going to happen. They're going to go to the same Ivy Leagues that their parents did, or they're going to, you know, get accepted into USC with like fake, like, padded, you know, I was a sailing person in high school or whatever. I rode crew or whatever it is that gets them into the schools. They're not going to go to East Tennessee State University. They're barely going to go to UCF. They're University of South. None of these schools are where elite students go to. People who go to state schools are people who really want an education. In my case, I really wanted to learn some shit. And they're people who don't have a choice to go anyplace else. I didn't have a choice to go anyplace else. If I had had a choice to go to anyplace else, Lord knows I would not have gone to East Tennessee State University. No one should be leaving East Tennessee State University with student debt. Oh my God. But I digress. There's more from Frank Luntz. Bernie to Biden, Biden wins. No, there's not any more from Frank Luntz. Let's move on to Pete Buttigieg, because Pete Buttigieg had the worst night. He had the worst night of everybody, and he actually had the worst night, I believe, of his entire appearances on the stage. And part of it was, like I mentioned before, he's clearly got an anger management problem, with especially with regard to women and arguing with women. But he's also got a huge problem just because of who he is. Now, Pete Buttigieg is coming onto the proverbial stage, as, you know, the outsider, not from the beltway. I'm like, you know, I'm the wild card. And he's trying to compare himself and draw a comparison and cozy up with the likes of John F. Kennedy or Obama or Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton. But there is a big difference between Pete Buttigieg, who is a mayor of a fourth tier Indiana city, and those four outsiders who had outstanding presidencies. So let's learn a little bit more about that from Mehdi Hasan on The Daily Show in an extraordinarily funny clip.
I think tonight we saw the first crack in the Pete Buttigieg electability argument. Till now, we're like, this is the guy. He's electable. And she pointed out, you know, the emperor has no clothes. This guy is a mayor from South Bend, Indiana. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many votes he won in 2015 to be reelected as mayor?
Like 8,000?
8,000, right. There's more people than that at an Asian wedding, right? At an Indian wedding. I had like half that many people at my wedding, right? That's his qualification? I'm going to win 70 million votes on the base of the 8,000 people in South Bend.
But now here's an argument many other people might make. They might go, if you look at the Democrats' history in the races, Democratic voters generally like to vote for somebody who doesn't have a long history in politics. Yeah. Many people would have said that Barack Obama came out of nowhere.
Definitely.
Many people said that Bill Clinton came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Many people said Kennedy came out of nowhere. And so if you look at the history of Democratic voters...
But ultimately, Kennedy was a senator, Obama was a senator, Clinton was a governor. They weren't mayor of the fourth biggest town in Indiana.
Right.
And I think that is a problem. And I do think Amy Klobuchar's right. She was just saying on CNN after the debate, there is a double standard here. Would we consider a 37-year-old person of color or a 37-year-old woman? Mm-hmm. They would be laughed off the stage in a way that a 37-year-old confident Harvard grad white guy isn't. And I think that is a problem. I think this idea that – I think there's a problem in the Democratic base as a whole, which is everyone's trying to play pundit. Everyone's saying, who's the most electable person?
Right.
Which is – you can't measure this stuff. I mean, there's a poll last week that showed pretty much every major candidate, including Klobuchar, can beat Trump nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So I say to people at home, watch, just vote for the person you think is best. Stop trying to be a pundit. I'm a pundit. We don't know what the hell we're talking about. Don't, you know, who predicted Trump? Very few of us.
Right.
Just stop playing that game. Pick the person you think would be the best leader who can heal this country after 4 years of kind of neo-fascism and white nationalism. And stop saying, stop obsessing over Joe Sixpack and who he's going to vote for, the guy in the diner in rural Pennsylvania.
Right, right, right.
He's probably going to vote for Trump again. Sorry to break it to you. Work on mobilizing your base. Work on mobilizing people of color. Work on mobilizing women. Work on mobilizing young people.
Okay, that was way too much, Mehdi Hasan. I apologize. But he made a couple of really good points there. He won by 8,000 points. Now, I have heard this figure inflated to 11,000 by his people and then looked it up. It was 8,000. He won by 8,000. Listen, South Bend, Indiana does not put him in the same league as a governor of Georgia, a governor of Arkansas, a senator from Illinois. You know, JFK was a senator. He's not in the same league. You know, it's not a statewide race. A statewide race is a totally different animal than a mayoral race or even a congressional race. In a congressional race, you're probably dealing with between 20 and 40,000 people, depending on where you live. You know, of course, statewide races, like for Senate or for governor, you have to appeal to everyone across the state. Pete Buttigieg running for president has to appeal to everybody in the country. And guess who supports Pete Buttigieg? White people, just white, basically just white people. He is not going to win. He's not going to win. He's not Amy Klobuchar is not going to win. She's going to get a boost from this particular debate because she did fairly well. You know, she nipped that problem with the anxiety in her voice, nipped it in the bud. It was a totally good night. She did bring the heat of 1,000 Karens. I tweeted out at one point last night, she makes me want to stress eat, which she reminds me of every horrible boss that I have ever had and just makes me want to go down to the vending machine and get some M&Ms. That is who Amy Klobuchar does to me. I don't think that that's going to translate into people going down to the voting machine and voting for her, unless maybe they bring a lot of M&Ms with them. Who knows? But I don't think Amy Klobuchar is it. I think that if people feel like they have to vote for a woman, I think that they're going to vote for Elizabeth Warren. Now I got to say, Elizabeth Warren, when these guys attack Elizabeth Warren the way that they do, when they go after her at these debates, I think that it backfires. She's not, now having said that, she has not been terribly good at standing up for herself, and that's really hurt her. But what's hurt her more is her backpedaling. So the injuries that she's suffered have been self-inflicted. And you know, she's got to come to terms with that. It's not this is not something that was pushed onto her. This is something she's done to herself. But I gotta say, as somebody who is 100%, 1,000%, all the percent behind Bernie Sanders, when I see Elizabeth Warren attacked on that stage, and you know, when people like try to go for her throat, I just, you know, I'm just like, that doesn't work. You know, get over yourself, try something else, go a different route. That just does not work for me. I thought I had a good Elizabeth Warren clip here, but let's instead move over to Mika Brzezinski on Morning Joe this morning. She had John Heilman on. He is an NBC and MSNBC national affairs reporter. We're exactly the same age. He's very well spoken. And Mika asks him about this Bernie blackout. She doesn't use the words Bernie blackout, but she wonders to Heilman, is there somebody we've overlooked? Is there somebody who's running who perhaps maybe could win, but we haven't been paying any attention to them? Help me out here. And Heilman, well, first let me play how she frames this up, because it's kind of funny.
And John Heilman, I want to ask you about Bernie Sanders, who's seeing a rising support among Hispanics. Is there a path for him? Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada? Is there a viable possibility for Bernie Sanders?
So, you know, it sounds to me like somebody handed her a note and said, hey, we got to talk about Bernie Sanders. And she was like searching for a way, like, could it be the Hispanic voters? Could it be, well, does he have a pass through? Since she names all of the early states, through Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, you know, not mentioning South Carolina, where, by the way, Bernie is gaining on Biden left and right. And center, left, right, and center. So, you know, there's a little bit of consternation. They're a little bit confused up there in the upper echelons of media elitedom. They don't know what to think about all of this. And so here comes John Hallman with his answer.
Bernie Sanders' resurgent after his heart attack could easily be number one or two in Iowa. There, then could easily be number one or two in neighboring New Hampshire, a primary he won with a wipeout with Clinton in 2016. And if that Hispanic support holds up for him, to have him then potentially win the Nevada caucuses, Bernie Sanders would have an awful lot of momentum coming out of those first three races. Again, making no predictions, but another person, so I said earlier today that you shouldn't count Amy Klobuchar out. Bernie Sanders is someone you really shouldn't count out, because right now he's looking stronger in the progressive lane than Elizabeth Warren is.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, John. Sanders looks to be in a pretty solid second place.
No one cares what you think over there. That was really interesting what he said. I mean, notice that Hallman starts out with, you know, after his heart attack, because he's got to remind you that. But after his heart attack, he's really come on strong and no one's been paying attention to him. And they're tying this to Hispanic support while ignoring African-American support and you know, the support that breaks along class lines and class divisions. So the way that MSNBC believes that it's okay to talk about Bernie Sanders is to talk about him with regard to or it connected to the Hispanic vote, which is, you know, I find that, you know, just a little bit funny. Let's see. I wanted to hit on a couple of other things. Joe Biden. We haven't talked about Joe Biden at all, which there isn't much to talk about. Chris Cuomo literally said of Joe Biden, and this was meant as a compliment, that he was alert and aware of his surroundings for the entire debate. Like that was put forth by Chris Cuomo, CNN, as I guess his best try at making Bernie or Biden, Joe Biden, seem viable. You know, the wine cave came up at least two times, if not more times. And then today we saw more of the clueless party elitists and media elitists wondering aloud. I'm looking at you, Clara Jeffrey, clueless elitists. Anyway, what's wrong with a wine cave? That's the way wine is made, is in caves, and that's an agricultural thing. So farmers, man. That's not the problem. The problem is that Pete Buttigieg did a fundraiser in a quote unquote wine cave that's really just like, you know, a fancy bunker that billionaires can write out the apocalypse on. Oh my God, I've got callers. Oh my God, I am so excited. You guys, I want you guys to call in and say hello and talk about, you know, some of your thoughts on the debate. We've got 20 minutes left. So I'm going to take a call right now from 912 area code. I'm putting you on right now. Hey there. You don't have to say your name. We can just call you 912. What's up?
How you doing?
I'm pretty good. What do you think? How was the debate?
Well, you know, it ain't really a debate, you know, until you have, like, both sides actually going at it. But what I would say, though, is that as far as Trump goes, I actually am a Trump supporter. You know, a lot of people in my neighborhood, you know, they can't believe it. But it's real, though. Damn it, like, you know, the Democrats, they want to take away our guns. They want to take away our freedom of speech. You know, they want to tell us that we can't call somebody what we want to. You know, it's a foul thing. It's all a game. It's rough. You know, and it's a very foul situation to live in, especially today, though, you dig? Because you got so many people that are so sensitive. Their parents didn't raise them right. You know, their parents told them that the world's going to be beautiful. You know, it's going to be rainbows and all these things. But, no, the world ain't like that. You dig what I'm saying? So what I would say, though, is that the people that understand reality, the people that are men, the people that are women, real women and real men, they understand what's going on, but and they don't respect it at all because, you know, the whole impeachment with Trump, they thought they was going to get rid of him with that, but no, they didn't. He's still our president. Mm-hmm. It's got to go to the Senate. They're going to throw it out. So, therefore, they really wasted a whole lot of taxpayers' dollars, you know, to chase a hatred. You dig what I'm saying? So they exposed their hand. And I'm sick of people saying they don't see that because it's in your face. They exposed their hand for being the frauds that they are and the messed up people that they are. They're not going to impeach Trump. Even if the House votes on it, that's one thing. But it's got to go to the Senate. They're going to throw it out. So either you either get Trump as a president again or you get Pence. You dig what I'm saying? So, and you know, and Pence has been trained by Trump for so many, you know, all this time, you know, and a lot of people don't know that Trump's only been in office for 3+, you know, a little over 3 years. You dig? Like, he ain't able to show his hand. So, when people try to come at him, but they attack him, you dig? They want to get him out of office, but he's only been in office for 3 years, a little over 3 years. They haven't gave him a chance. You dig? So there's something wrong.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Thank you for your call. I'm going to respond. I'm going to respond to a couple of things you said. I agree with a lot that you said. So here goes. 912. First of all, on guns, you know, gun control actually became a thing when the Black Panthers were, you know, arming themselves to protect themselves, you know, back in the late 60s and early 70s. That's when everyone got really concerned about gun control. And the first round. And then, you know, you didn't hear much about it. And then all of these school shootings and so on and so forth happened. I highly recommend Mark Ames's book called Going Postal to understand some of the problems behind spree shooting and workplace shooting. I think that it really helps. Another thing that 912 had to say is that impeachment doesn't remove the president. And he's absolutely right. Impeachment is a political maneuver. It doesn't automatically remove a president. When Nixon was impeached, he then resigned. So and I think a lot of people draw upon that Watergate history and think that it automatically results in the that president going away forever. There's a lot going on with the politics behind impeachment, and it's just very sticky. I thank you so much for your call. And it reminded me of one other thing too. So here's a little bit of talk out of school. You know, I've worked with groups that do GOTV that have adhered to this idea of rising American electorate and or fusion voting, which is what they do is they go into Black and brown communities and they try to register everybody and they try to GOTV everybody because they assume that everybody in these communities will automatically vote Democratic. And I think that that is incredibly condescending. And to tell you the truth, the people that I talked to who were actually working on these projects in the last cycle also saw it as incredibly condescending. And from what went on in Florida, especially in Osceola County in Florida, which is just south of Orlando, there was a ton of GOTV expecting everyone who was touched by these canvassers would go out and vote Democratic. They were Trump, a lot were Trump supporters for other reasons, cultural reasons, reasons having to do with exactly what I think this caller was talking about, with regard to a kind of cultural realism, if I can, talk about, frame up his comment as a kind of cultural realism. So thank you so much, 912. I'm going to move on. I've got 574. Hey, 574, you've been on for a while. Thank you for staying on. What was going on with that debate?
Well, first of all, Joe Biden couldn't ride a bicycle around the block without dying. So think about that. That's kind of a consideration. And nobody made any sense, including you, in the last 10 or 12 minutes. You got stumbled by that guy that happened to be a black guy that said he supported Trump. And you had no idea what to say. You had no argument against any of the points that he made, and he made a couple. And that's it.
I don't have an argument against his points. All right, 574. I don't have an argument against his points. I don't. I agree with him. That's why I don't have an argument against him. I think he made very good points. I think that a lot of the identity politics that the Democratic Party is partaking in right now, especially the elites in the party, they're using that and they're using impeachment as a shortcut for doing actual political work. And I find it disgusting, and I find it condescending. And I think you're absolutely right to get your ass on your shoulders about it. And you should take that right straight where it belongs to the party. I'm not party, I'm persona non grata with the party. 321, Space Coaster.
Hey, great show.
What did you think of the debate, man?
Well, I thought you made a lot of good points. I kind of saw it, a lot of it the same way. I thought that it
been kind of slow, and I thought maybe this will be the worst debate ever. And then somewhere around the time they had that free-for-all melee and everybody was talking over each other, they kind of settled in and everybody kind of planted their feet. And I thought everybody, frankly, looked better than they have lately, except maybe Mayor Pete. Except definitely Mayor Pete. I think he got hammered, like you said, over the wine cave and his overall, inability to deal with criticism. He seemed to lock up every time he tangled horns with somebody.
Was there somebody who you thought came out of this as a big winner?
Oh, I'm sorry. Could you say that again?
Was there somebody who you thought was a big winner of the night?
Well, I'm a Bernie person. I thought he did great. I thought he did as well as he ever had. And then as Cuomo, I guess you said, pointed out, I worry about Biden, but I think it was amazing that he seemed to have his wits together for the entire thing. That's an unfortunate highlight, for him. But he sounded mostly coherent. I thought it was odd when one of the moderators tried to buttonhole Sanders with Obama's comments about old men needing to get out of the way, and Sanders did his thing, and then Biden said, "Well, he definitely wasn't talking about me." just because it's his friend Obama that he's not subject to the same criticism. And I think it was unfortunate for him because it's pretty clear that he maybe does have some old man reasons not to be in there. That's not even a knock on him, really. He doesn't seem prepared for this. And it's kind of a frightening proposition that he, you know, that he would be the nominee and potentially the president, because he's really having some difficulties. The man's talking about his leg hair and stuff. He should, you know, he deserves a rest. And I thought it was a win for him, but it just made me wonder why Biden is the presumptive leader. I thought Klobuchar didn't shake, like you said. She seemed calmer. She seemed more relaxed. I don't think she mentioned the Russian menace one time, which is to her favor. And I had a similar response to Yang, who I thought sounded very smart on the impeachment thing. I was glad to see someone swimming upstream on that. But then every time he talks about policy, I get the same, you know, libertarian alert in the back of my head that you do. I think he's someone who imagines he can make policy out of some notion of objective rationality that doesn't exist, probably. So, but
you know, with Yang, one of the things that really strikes me with Yang, and especially with Yang's support, well, this is a Yang supporter thing, is I think that Yang's supporters are people who are some of the most marginal and some of the most hurting people in the electorate, because they are being attracted to the UBI. And I think that UBI needs to be taken seriously by other candidates. There was a person in the Frank Luntz group who was a Yang supporter who had a heart-wrenching story about his own struggles with healthcare, people in his family, so on and so forth. And, you know, he talked about all these struggles and people losing their home. And then he said, you know, I'm a Yang supporter. And, you know, I was just like that gif of the guy who's like, what? You know, because $1,000 a month is not going to cover it when it comes to the kind of financial ruin that will happen when you have an unexpected emergency at the hospital. When you have an unexpected emergency in the hospital, you're talking $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. It's not going to be $1,000 a month to help you.
Yeah, I had the same thoughts about UBI. I mean, it's almost the give a man a fish versus teach him to fish parable. And I hate that parable, the way it's usually used. But the kinds of institutional reforms that the other candidates are talking about that I think Yang is trying to replace with this, it's kind of like a flat tax type idea. You know, it's simple and it has a certain, you know, primitive appeal because it's across the board. But if you think of the impact that it would have, it's negative and it's regressive. Because inevitably something like that is offered in place of other social programs or other improvements. And I think it's a kind of grasping at straws kind of thing by someone who's naive as to policy. I mean, I just think that type of thing, it can be discussed, but what he's proposing in the framework that's presented in is dangerous.
I agree. And thank you so much, 321 Space Coaster, for calling in. By the way, if you're not aware, 321 area code is the countdown. And so when you see someone with a 321 area code, that means they're in and around the Space Coast, Brevard County of Florida. Thanks again. You know, everybody who's calling in, please call again. I've got 404. I think that's an Atlanta area code. 404. Hey, what's up? What'd you think of the debate?
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, it was okay. I think at a certain point this stuff gets presented like NFL countdown, and that becomes a problem where we're waiting on these, you know, specific moments or gaps. And I think that makes it a little harder to separate the contents from the container. Meaning, when we've got people who are funded in a certain way and they speak around issues that are inherently progressive, but on issues that are more conservative and appeals to, you know, people who are so-called independent, we kind of got to wonder what we have as far as what the field is. Like, as far as Yang, I mean, this is like typical libertarian stuff. It's real dreamy. It sounds as if it could be effective, as the last man said, but when you talk about really implementing it, it's not even solving the things that he would, say that it does. Like, that program was part of Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton's program, where they were talking about baby bonds, job guarantees, like this whole, huge comprehensive idea of what has to be done going forward as far as jobs and everything else. And he comes in and just takes the UBI part and presents that as if that would be a substantial change to people's lives. And then on the back end, he has all this rhetoric about getting rid of certain social safety net programs and the idea that this $1,000 a month would replace them, as you just said, which is not really even feasible. So I'm looking at this thing like, okay, Bernie probably is going to raise the Overton window, but probably not win. But what we're looking at is essentially the Dem Party deciding that their donors and backers are more important than what the electorate actually wants, which is real comprehensive change, actual health care, not access to health care, real ideas about what the job market is going to be going forward. And, I mean, some institutions are going to have to change. Now, if we creep along and speak about climate change only in, fear-mongering rhetoric and not getting to the practical issue of, okay, these things are going to happen and we have to be prepared for them and we have to, figure out solutions for them. Like, those are things that have to be talked about. But, when we're just having one-offs on who can get a one-liner in, I don't know, man. At a certain point, this becomes a farce. And I don't know. It's a dereliction of duty to me, like, looking at this. And as far as, like, Joe and stuff, like, go home, Joe. Like, come on. You're clearly not who you were 10 years ago. There are some issues. And just hearing him, with this idea that, oh, we just have to appeal. Look, people have been out here on Facebook and every other social media platform trying to change family members' minds since 2016. The idea that you're going to go after that voting group and change their minds still, I don't get why people do this. There needs to be real progressive policy, and they need to go after actual Dem voters, not these people whose minds aren't going to change, as we've read a million different diner stories about how they're not actually racist. They just got economic anxiety or whatever other trope they want to throw out. So, yeah, I don't know. I watched it. Like I said, it was interesting. Oh, and I forgot about old Pete. Corporate Pete got to go. Like, this guy, like point blank period. If a huge part of your electorate is a population that does not like this man, the idea that because certain donors do like this man and continue to give him money, that they should rise in your party, it's like you're trying not to win. Like, if you want people to stay home, yeah, give him the nomination. Like, there are a lot of people who are extremely, extremely uneasy about this guy because everything seems real crafted and corporate. He's essentially what corporate America would make if they wanted a politician that would be, the most milquetoast, non-policy pushing person who can word salad his way out of anything. So,
and look at how the donors love him. They did the big wine cave thing. So we just have like a minute left. I want to thank you so much for the call, because I think you're my favorite call. You're absolutely right. We've got a problem with the donors. That really goes to the heart of the problem. You can't serve both masters. You can't serve the donors and the voters. So listen, thank you so much, 404, for calling in. Please call again. We'll be doing more of this. Very insightful, and I so appreciate you listening. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Damn it, I did not mean to cut off the end of his thanks a lot. Okay, you guys, I am going to leave you with some music, and I want you to tune in on Sunday for a very good show. And wow, thanks for listening. Good night. good stuff. Catch you on Sunday, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. We'll go a little bit deeper. We'll have some more stuff to talk about. So, see you then, 7 o'clock Sunday evening. Ciao.